I'll tell you, for example.
Give me a whole list.
I'll tell you, for example, when Richard uses words like God, or spiritual, and occasionally you call upon the name of Christ, I think, wow, that's...
The great way is not
that's
difficult.
Far out.
The great way... The great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. When love and hate are both absent, everything becomes clear and undisguised. But make the slightest distinction, and heaven and earth are set infinitely apart. To have the form and the formless.
Yeah. But yet the words do have semantic meaning. And as I said,
the fact that you are reacting to those is your problem. It's your attachment. I use God the way I use it. Why should that upset you? It's none of your business what words I use to talk about what model. They're just scenarios. It's like Walter Cronkite saying that's the way it is tonight. That's just the way Walter Cronkite thinks it is tonight.
But I also think of the semantic meaning to other people.
Yeah,
what the word God would mean or the word Christ would mean.
I think it means a mystery, a doorway to an unknown, an unnameless Yahweh, The 99 names, none of which say what it is. And don't you want to keep everybody right at the edge of the form and the formless? Because that's where the ultimate act of creation is. For some people, God is a total drag, and for other people, it's a doorway. And I just send out as many doorways as I can, because all the doorways lead to the same place as far as I'm concerned.
Hey, everybody. It's Katrina from Zooming in the Lens podcast. I'm not going to do a ton of, intro talking today. I think I'm just going to let you loose on everybody. But we've got good friend named Hank Fortner. Is that right?
Fortinier. But people call me Fortner. That's the other way.
Fortner.
Fortinier is my sophisticated name. When I'm in Hollywood, I say I'm Fortinier.
And what about when you're in Jersey?
When I'm in Jersey, it's just Hank. I'm usually the only Hank people know. My Instagram is actually at Hank. I just have Aunt Hank. And I'm keenly aware of how many animals are named Hank. Because people tag their dogs. Yeah, the dogs, hamsters, pigs. It's crazy. So I just usually tell people I'm probably the only Hank, who's a human.
Who's a human.
So I tell people not to worry about my last name.
That's good. But it is nice anyway. So welcome, Hank.
Thanks. Great to be here.
I'm glad that you're here.
I'm here in your studio/temple.
Yes, studio.
Studio.
Studio/temple ashram kind of thing. Yep. We're in Los Angeles right now, and I met Hank through a student's Christmas party,
mm-hmm.
and the student said, you're just going to love this guy, and I did immediately, because he's part philosopher, part, I'll say, not non-academic theologian like me.
Sure.
Seeker, and you're a giver.
Oh, thanks.
Which is the most important thing.
I like that.
You are. You're
like
a giver.
That.
You know you're a giver, right?
Yeah.
You're a giver. And you have a really interesting story that I want you to sort of tell everybody.
Sure.
But I will at least say that Hank, he's an entrepreneur. Because basically that means that he and I are both crazy and we want whiteboards all over our studios so we
yes.
can write a million notes on stage. I'll tell you, it's the Post-it company. I should have stock in them.
Yeah, or you should get them to sponsor this podcast.
I should, yeah.
Yeah, then if they sponsor the podcast, then maybe they'll send you some of these Post-its that I see all over your place.
It's the full-body Post-its
exactly.
that I'm getting into now.
The wall-length Post-its.
Yep, the wall-length Post-its. Oh, I know. Did you ever see this? I have a quote on my wall that I'm pointing to right now, but it's by a guy that I don't really know so well, but his name is Jamie Caddo. And he says, we are each of us a wise guru in charge of a mental patient. That's his example of what it is to be human.
Nice. I like that.
And I think you're part of my club.
Nice. I feel like sometimes I feel like the mental patient in charge of a guru.
I think we all do.
I have days like that, and then I feel like a wise, you know, then I feel like I am controlling, but some days I feel controlled by that mental patient instead.
Oh my God, you and I both. Yeah, what interests me about what you do is that you are a pastor.
Mm-hmm.
Don't click off the podcast.
People are like, run, or they're like, skip. You know, you do it with ads. You're like, yeah, I'm just going to fast forward. Oh, I passed her.
Fast forward to next episode. I know. But, I mean, for any of you that know me well enough to know that I quote religious scripture often,
mm-hmm,
because it's all for interpretation. And there's a lot of wise words. So I'm really not into throwing the baby out with the bathwater.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, besides being a pastor, you have fostered a company called Adopt Together,
mm-hmm,
which I'll let you sort of give a brief of what that is. You're also writing a book.
Mm-hmm.
And you have your own podcast.
Yeah.
Yeah, you have two.
A couple of them, yeah.
Yeah, one for Adopt Together, which is just the coolest thing. Adopt Together is this, it's the first crowdfunding, what would you call it?
Platform. Yep. Environment.
Yeah, environment to help place children with people who want to be parents.
Mm-hmm.
Crowdfunding. So, I mean, imagine that if you're hearing this, like crowdfunding is, you know, in one context, like this commercial way to solicit merchandise, but we're talking about children.
Yeah.
But that's how important it is.
Sure.
Because there are so many children that can't get into the homes of people that, and there's so many people that want children or, mm-hmm, want to guide or be guides.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it is to me.
Yeah.
And you've raised, oh God, I can't remember by heart, so I'm going to be looking at this paper. But
we just hit $8 million the day before yesterday. $8 million in 4 years.
Wow, in 4 years.
Yeah, it's been awesome.
And how many families?
Almost 2,000. We're about to hit our 2,000th family. So I'm going to post about the family that received the $8 millionth donation. And then in a couple of, probably in a week or two, we'll post our 2,000th family.
Whoa.
Which is really exciting. To have those, just to get to be a part of those stories, because you know, as you know, we have so many friends who have adopted. We are, even our mutual friends have adopted, mm-hmm, and it's just cost prohibitive for a lot of people. And there's so many kids that would fit super well in so many families, and the reason that they don't is because those families don't have the $30,000, sometimes $40,000 to bring their children home. And so, what we wanted to do was create a Kickstarter for adoption. And we launched right after Kickstarter launched. When Kickstarter came out, we were like, oh, good, we don't have to do this. Oh, good, this is going to be possible. And the founder of Kickstarter, we met together, one of the co-founders, and he was adopted. And he said, you got to do this. We're never going to do a charity thing on Kickstarter, so it's going to have to be you. And so we got together and put it together. And now 4 years later, we're thousands of kids in. And it's been amazing. So we don't do any of any individual placement. And we don't vet families for adoption.
Mm-hmm. When you say you don't do any individual placement, like translate that. What does that actually look like?
So that would mean if there was a birth mother in Northridge, California, who said, I want to place my baby up for adoption. She would not place her child with us, and then we would find a family for that child. She would go through lawyers and adoption agencies and people who are equipped to facilitate that kind of very sensitive and very tender interaction. We would then help the adoptive family raise the funds in order to pay for that process, mm-hmm, which can be in the, you know, tens and twenties and thirties of thousands of dollars.
And so the prospective parents also have to pay the adoption agency?
Yeah.
Can you do it without an agency?
You can if you go through the foster care system, but even then you'll incur costs, sometimes $2,000 or $3,000. But at that point, it's a different type of adoption you're going through. Sometimes you can go through an adoption where you go, I adopt from foster care and I might get a 2-week-old. But the majority of the time, you're getting a 6-, 7-, or 8-year-old.
Right.
And a lot of times, if you have a young couple, let's say, who's adopting, they're not equipped to parent an 8-year-old yet. Like for me, I don't have any 8-year-olds. I have a 4-year-old and a 1.5-year-old, and that is as far as equipped as I am to handle. And that's what happens in sort of that evolution. So for some families, foster care is the right move. And I think the key for us is just helping families along the way with whatever adoption process is right for them.
Yeah, I think what I really like about it is you're also fostering community.
Huge, yeah.
Which I think is really different because adoption can feel, as I'm told, very isolating.
Sure.
And you're waiting for this call and you have a lot invested in this. Yep. And I mean, let's be honest here, we're talking about feelings, you know?
Yeah.
A lot of feelings that, you know, up and down, up and down. But when you're thinking of crowdfunding, it immediately makes me think about everybody's on here for the same reason.
Yep.
And at the end of it, which I would imagine is a lot like being naturally pregnant.
Yeah.
You know, you have those endorphins, but the whole time you're going through that pain, you know that at the end it's for something.
Yeah, totally. And it's just like that Hillary Clinton quote, and I don't know if she said it first, but the "it takes a village to raise a child" mentality. What she did, and the reason that quote has traveled so far and so long, is you're just putting into language the way people feel about people who are pregnant or have children or are part of that. It's just like why people, no matter whose kid it is, if they're hanging over the side of a shopping cart and it looks like it's going to fall over, strangers will tell you, hey, or if your kid is cold. Like, there is this natural protective tendency. And with adoption, it's not as obvious as a baby bump, and it's not as obvious as being pregnant. Or when a woman is pregnant, it's obvious. Her boobs get bigger. Her body gets bigger. Her stomach gets bigger. She's waddling a little bit. It's like you can tell when a person is pregnant, whereas you can't tell when a person might be within inches of their adoption.
That's right.
Where they might be an expectant mother, but don't look that way. And I think Adopt Together gives a digital experience to bring community to what otherwise could be a lonely process.
Yeah.
But I feel like there's so many large events in life, and life events are oftentimes the loneliest moments because it brings about the biggest awareness of need for people to be with you. And high intensity, high emotional spaces bring about a need to go, I need to process this with someone. Who can I call? Who could I talk to about this? And I think that's why people go to church or they go to therapists mm-hmm. when they have life events, because it accentuates that sense of either community or loneliness. And so for us with Adopt Together, the philosophy is, you know, if a donor came through and said, hey, we're just going to fund that adoption, I would say, yeah, wait. And let's let people in that person's life give first. And then we'll cover whatever is the shortfall.
Mm.
But I want people to have the opportunity to be a part of each other's life in that intense life event that accentuates the sense of community through the intensity of that moment. And we have people years later will say that people who donated $50, $100 to the process, they treat our child like they are uncles and aunts because they go, I was a part of that. And they got to be a part of it with a small amount of money. But it made possible this adoption, and they feel that ownership of the process and that kinship in a lot of ways to that child.
What must that feel like to know that you're such a vehicle for, I mean, you're a vehicle for love, I guess. Right?
Yeah, totally. You know, that actually requires discipline to feel that, because most of the time it feels like legal terms and web hosting and yeah. IRS forms.
It
does not feel like doing good. You have to pull yourself back and pause. And that's what we do as a team and go, we got to read these emails from these mothers and we've got to see these photos. And we're about to shoot a thing called Trusted Friends. And we're going to shoot a dinner that we do with a family who are home with their child. Because you can't even put into your mind, what do 2,000 kids and parents look like in a room? That would be like, if you put even all the parents together, you're talking about 6,000. That's a small spring training baseball stadium
Full
of the people who have now been, and then you have 25 to 30,000 donors who have been a part of that. So the amount of people who have had a significant life-changing experience through this, we have to remind ourselves of it, because otherwise it feels a lot like fundraising, and it feels a lot like meetings with donors, and it feels a lot like putting together pitch decks and Mother's Day funds. And there's a lot of stuff that goes into it that doesn't feel like life change, but the benefit and the reward is to be able to look back and go, look at all these families and look at all these stories.
Yeah, and it sounds a lot like the processes of all things that are big life events.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, for practicing yoga in physical or non-physical, there's this harvesting process where it's not supposed to be easy.
Right.
It's not supposed to be every day you wake up and go, wow, I'm really glad yesterday I went, or yesterday I meditated, or you might see results or never see results.
Totally.
That's that whole process that you're going through. Yep. But there's, I guess what I'm trying to say is that I'm grateful in the small places along the ladder, if there is one, for where I am now, because I'm able to see that without those moments of IRS forms and tax forms, we don't stop and ever pause.
Yeah, right.
And so if we didn't have any automatic response systems of being human and being in the world,
yeah,
we wouldn't have any reason to pause.
Yeah, right.
So it's the inception of the pause, really. And mm-hmm. look, you're that's what you're doing. You're stopping and you're reading the emails. It's no different than me stopping and going to the puja table, or
sure.
having satsang around, community around, to all go, are you crazy? I'm crazy. Oh my God, I feel really crazy.
Right, totally, totally.
Today I'm the wise guru, and yeah. tomorrow I'm the inmate.
Exactly.
And I think that's why what you're doing is working, because at the base of all of it is you're like a love guru, you know?
Yeah. Absolutely.
I think that's so important. And what a great idea. How did you get into this? Like, tell us about your childhood
origin story. Yeah, totally.
I loved it, because I know, you know, the first time that you and I met was at that party, but then we were like, I have to do this again.
Yeah.
And we met at a cafe somewhere here. We were supposed to meet for an hour. It was 4 hours later. Because you are an appreciator of neuroscience.
Yeah, absolutely.
And spirituality meeting yep. science.
Yep.
As well as faith and scriptures of mm-hmm. all sorts.
Mm-hmm.
And you're the mental patient most of the time with me.
Absolutely.
So, I'm inspired to meet somebody. I really want to tell anybody listening to this. If I was a man, I would be Hank.
And if I was a woman, I would be you. I mean, although I've been accused of being the female version of myself also already.
Well, that's a compliment. You're embodying.
That's exactly right. Yeah, that's exactly right. I grew up in a family in central Ohio, southern Ohio, near Cincinnati. And my family's awesome. My mother and father, both wonderful, grew up Catholic, raised Catholic, got pregnant, and that's when you know. In the 80s, when you got pregnant, it was time to get married. That was like, oh, we're engaged, I guess. So they got married, and they were both 21 years old. So they had my sister at 21, me at 22, my brother at 24. And pregnancy was really difficult on my mom, even though she was young. So the doctor said, I would not recommend having other biological children. And so they tied her tubes while she was on the recovery table for her C-section. For my little brother, and three kids in, she wept on the table and said, what have I done? And told my dad, God put me on earth to be a mother.
Wow.
And he said, God put me on earth to make you happy. So tell me what we're doing. How are we going to do this? And he was actually the one who brought up, we can always adopt. We can either get this process reversed or go in vitro. We can always adopt. And she said, okay. So they went to the state. And the state said, well, you know, adoption is a really long process, but we have kids immediately available in foster care. Do you want to be a foster parent? And this woman who was telling her about it, who was just a friend of hers, goes, I'm fostering a little girl. You can have her if you want. Like, we needed a home for her, and they want to move her from my house, so I'll tell her that she should go to your house. And that little girl was my sister, Hope.
Mm.
And she came into our home, and my mom said, yep. And we started fostering her, and we adopted her.
How old is she?
She was a year and a half at the time. Maybe 10 months when we got her, a year and a half when we adopted her. And she was fetal alcohol syndrome. So if you're familiar with fetal alcohol, it has a lot of cognitive effects and a lot of physical effects and has a physical look. You can meet people and kind of know that was fetal alcohol. And mom was a heavy alcohol drug user while she was pregnant. She was a prostitute locally. And once she got out of prison, she had somewhat of a relationship with my little sister. And, you know, they kind of know who each other is at this point, but not a deep relationship. But that started our journey, and my parents started fostering kids. So growing up, I had 36 foster brothers and sisters over a 7-year period.
Hank.
And
wow,
man, did we have a busy, busy household.
What was Christmas like?
Christmas was really hard. And that, I think the Christmas was the hardest part, because we would have these amazing Christmases with a little brother. And at 7 or 8 years old, you have this little brother and he's Christmas and you get him a toy. And then the next Christmas, the state might decide that that child needs to go somewhere else. And so you do Christmas, but without that little brother again. So it was similar to, I think, the way families feel when they've lost someone.
Yeah.
But we lost someone every Christmas.
Oh, man.
And sometimes multiple kids per Christmas. And so you just go. It got to the point where Christmas is a really nostalgic, very emotional time for me, even as a 34-year-old adult, because there's this Mariah Carey song that says, "I miss you most at Christmas time." And when that I first heard that song, I just wept, because I thought that song is finally putting it into context why Christmas was just a really nostalgic and really heavy time for our family. So we don't have Christmas traditions. Christmas dinner at our family is sort of like just food on the counter, because it was just really hard for us to formalize anything that would remind us of who wasn't there. So Christmas is a busy time, and we still do Christmas morning, and we still do that kind of stuff. But my wife, when we were first dating, she came with me to Christmas dinner at my house, and she cried. And I was like, "What is the problem here?" And she's like, "This just isn't real, and it's not happening, and people are just around," and it just felt too casual for her. And I don't think I had to interpret for her the context that I was becoming aware of through her eyes, that we shied away from formalizing any Christmas experiences because it just reminded us of who wasn't at the table. So we don't set a table. We didn't have seats because it was too obvious which of the high chairs were empty. Mm. So that became a really brutal season for us,
yeah.
Especially as a young man, and as my sister is a young woman, and my little brother, we all kind of responded to it in different ways. I think my older sister responded to it saying, "Okay, if people are going to be taken from us, then it's only blood." And she has very high walls and doesn't let a lot of people in. She has a lot of relationships, but if you're family, you're family, and don't you mess that up. My little brother responded a similar way, like very close, tight-knit, small groups of friends that stay friends for decades. For me, I responded by saying, "Cool, if everybody's family and you're going to lose them, then everybody gets in." And so I have this very, what a lot of people would call, dysfunctional sense of like who family is.
No, that's a yogi.
My wife would get so mad because our planning of the wedding, I wanted to invite 3 people that I had met that week. And she's like, "You're not inviting them to our wedding and then cutting out people we've known for years." I'm like, "Yeah, but I have a future with this person." Like in my mind, I was like, "No, I'm going to invite who I perceive these people are in right now." And some people have been in and they've chosen to move out, and that's fine. Good on them. They do whatever they want to do. But when a person has to go, they have to go. Like, I had a very open-handed sense of who was in and who wasn't out, which is confusing to people. And I people need more concrete nature of like, "Am I in? Am I in?" You're sure, as long as you want to be. So I think that's kind of how we all reacted.
Wow. You know, it reminds me of this story that Ram Dass tells, about when he had gotten back from India and he had Be Here Now, and his father was a corporate dude and very high-powered in Boston. And he was only selling the book for, I mean, don't quote me on this, but like $4 or something
like that,
which even back then was not a lot of money for the book. And his father said, like, "Why are you doing that? You could be selling," or maybe it wasn't the book, maybe it was a record, the Love, Serve, Remember record. It was something that he was selling. And his father's just thinking numbers. It's not like anything was wrong with him, but he's thinking, like, "Why wouldn't you charge, you know, $10 or $15 or whatever?"
Right.
And Ram Dass was at this place where he thought, you know, anything I say is not going to really make sense. So he took this great approach with his dad with, "Dad, do you remember when, you know, a couple years ago when you," because his father was a lawyer as well, "when you did the case for Uncle," I forget his name.
Yeah.
And he says, "Yeah." And he says, "Probably spent a lot of money, and that was like a lot of hours." And he's like, "Yeah." And he says, "So how much did you charge, Uncle?" And the father says, "Oh, give me a break. That's ridiculous. I would never charge the uncle. He's my blah, blah, blah."
Yeah.
And Ram Dass said,
Yeah, right.
It lies my problem.
Yeah, right.
Because everybody
is an uncle.
Is an uncle.
Or a brother.
Uncle
or
Henry,
a cousin.
I think it is.
Yeah, wow.
And that's what your story's reminding me of that.
Yeah, totally.
So continue on, yeah.
So then my parents decided that the foster care process was really difficult on our family, so we started adopting. So my dad actually is the one who put his foot down and said, permanence. We can take any child into our home, but there has to be permanence.
Because so the heart was breaking.
Not healthy for the kids, not healthy for all of us, not a healthy system for a government to decide where a child should go based on an algorithm that was probably old and should never have been determining where kids go.
Right.
So we started adopting. So my parents went on to adopt 8 kids from 6 different countries.
Oh.
And not because my parents were like, hey, which country should we go to now? But always with a crazy coincidental moment or story or person that they met, similar to the woman who said, hey, there's a girl who's in my house. You should take her because the state's going to move her. It was very similar. We had friends in Bolivia who were planting churches in Bolivia, and they said, I've got this woman. Her partner is a drug dealer who says that he doesn't want anything to do with the girls. She has 2 daughters. She's a prostitute who needs to move to a different city because the police are kind of onto her.
Mm-hmm.
And we have these 2 kids, and we'll adopt one if you'll adopt the other, but we can't handle both. And so my parents was like, yep. So they went down, and they adopted her. Her name is Lucia. And my parents adopted Gabby, who's my little sister, who's now like 27, 28 years old. And then same story. A woman came up to my mom at a Thanksgiving party and said, I'm pregnant. I heard what your family does. Would you adopt my child? I'll carry this baby to term if you'll adopt this child. And my mom said, done and done. Like it was always these scenarios where once you open your life like that and put yourself in that place and you're in the posture of yes, then children and opportunity came.
Doing your dharma, right?
Yeah.
Doing your dharma, which is really what we're all trying to hear. We're trying to all get to a place where we could hear what that is. I know there's like a large chunk of America doesn't have that sort of calling.
Right.
Your parents did, and they followed it.
Yep.
And what are the chances that a man and a woman are going to meet?
Yeah, right.
And be on the same page?
Yeah. Well, I don't think my dad would have gotten into it. I don't think my dad would have gone there. I think my dad was in a posture of, my role is to support you in your life and in your dream. And I think her thought was, my role is to support you in your... I mean, they were just leaning towards each other. And as the clarity came for my mom about what she wanted to do with her life and in the world and what work she wanted to bring forward, my dad had a similar clarity that he was going to support that work and support who she was.
Wow.
So I think there's a power to that. I feel that way with my wife and our partnership. If the minute my wife has clarity, I would lean right into it and go, yes, we need to do that. And the minute I communicate clarity, my wife always goes, here's how we can do that and here's how we can accomplish that. So I feel like I found that in my wife as well, is that we lean towards each other. And sometimes my wife's clarity will be about something small, whether it's something we should wear or buy or go to versus something we should do or a work we should build together or something like that.
Yeah, that's interesting, because what you're saying is if you can follow a call, not the call, but a call, maybe many.
Sure.
That as you lean into it, you take the skillful action, as we would say, it'll touch you back.
Yeah.
And that's important, because that does require an element of experience or faith.
Mm-hmm.
Because
for sure,
taking that leap to go, all right, well, if I just quit this job and lean into this,
right,
what if it doesn't touch me back?
Right.
So how does that work? Like, what if... what if they don't lean back?
Your partner?
Yeah.
I think it's important to realize that no call, I shouldn't say no call, most calls, it's rare that a call would be more important than the call to be with that partner that you felt at one point. And so some of it may be, where I would place that is to say, if you are still in auditioning mode, which is what I would call dating, then you go, is this person going to lean with me into this work of my life. And if they're not, then I think you reevaluate if that's a person you want to lean towards. But I think once you make a covenant with your spouse and you go, we're married together, I think you come to a place where you're leaning into that person, and that's the any covenant like that, that's a covenant that has superseded any of those other calls that might come forward.
Right.
And I don't want to say that that's universal, because I'm certain there's objections to that, but that's where I would put it with my wife, is to say there are some calls that she's not on board for. And I have to pay attention to that and realize that what the calling that is bigger than that, or the work of my life that I'm bringing forward that's more important than the other work, is the work of our marriage and the work of our home and the work of my family,
right,
which I'll put before the work of calling or career or any of those things.
So that's your main intention, mm-hmm. which is what I'm always working with myself in my own practice and trying to inspire students to do as well, is if there's a main intention,
yeah,
it doesn't matter how much money you're going to make. If it doesn't suit that main intention, there really isn't any confusion.
Yeah, right.
But also, I feel like the main intention can't be too linear. It has to be out affecting others too.
Right, absolutely.
So it can't be the intention of I want $1 million.
Right.
I mean, it can, but the real fruit comes when it's not just all about you.
Yeah. And I would put it, I've never used the word intention for it, although I like that. I would put it in the phraseology of value. So there's a neuroscientist by the name of Andrew Newberg out of Philadelphia or Pittsburgh or some P word, Eastern City.
Yeah.
And he wrote a book called How Words Change Your Brain.
Mm-hmm.
And so much of that is basically the neuroscience of the meditative practice of beginning your day, focusing on, and I've been doing this since I read his book, what are my deepest values? So I meditate every morning on what are my deepest values? What are the values that will drive all the noise and all the speed and all the demands and all the requests and all the inquiries on my life? And I center it all around my deepest values to care for, protect, and build my family. And I just focus on to care for, protect, and build my family. And I want to be faithful to my family in all the ways that that means, from my marriage to being faithful to my kids, I want to be faithful to them in all the ways that that means, whether it's faithful with my word or faithful with my sexuality, with my wife, mm-hmm. whether I'm faithful with my commitments to my daughters, whether I'm present. And I think to me that supersedes, and I, as an entrepreneur, I guess is a fun word for me to call myself.
Yeah.
I just call myself crazy.
Me too.
Is I have 7 ideas a day and 4 books I want to write and 3 ideas.
Yep.
And I think I started a company this morning over the phone with my lawyer. Yeah. And I think we did. And I think we got a partnership and it's going to be awesome. And then and it's moving very fast. And I kind of go, at the end of the day, I can have all the ideas in the world. And I can have new ones, and I'm driven entirely by enthusiasm some days.
Yeah.
But I think the true test of your life is what commitments and covenants you kept where the enthusiasm was not the driving force, but something supersedes, something transcends the way you feel about it. And you go, no, this is something that I'm actually building.
But what if you don't know that?
Don't know what?
Well, let's say that there's people listening that, and I'm sure you will remember a time, maybe not because of your unique upbringing,
sure,
about giving. But what if there's people out there that aren't feeling that their true intention is something outside of themselves?
Like, sure.
What are the steps to
finding that?
To sort of getting real about it.
Yeah, I think it's a leaning. For me, I've never had a hard time finding things that enthused me or excited me. But I have had seasons where I felt numb to it, where I just felt like I'm not excited about my job. I'm not excited about work. I'm tired. I'm overworked, overwhelmed. I'm not in an inspiring place. And I would fall prey to that very, how should I say, a seductive thought that somehow the adventure is somewhere else. And I would drive on the roads, and I would see sunsets and think somewhere someone is living their dream, and I'm not. I'm stuck. I just felt stuck.
Yeah.
And I think when you're in that place, it's sort of like playing Settlers of Catan. Have you ever played Settlers of Catan?
No.
It's a fantastic game. It's like a cross between Risk and Monopoly.
Really?
And it's all about resources. And what I find when I play Settlers of Catan is that I always complain about not having resources when all the while I can actually win with the resources I have. And I get beat by people with less resources because they're not trying to find it somewhere else. They just use what they have. And I find myself, the game ends and I have more resources where I could have won, I just didn't use them. And I feel like so much of what I realized is as I searched for intention and as I searched for those callings outside of myself, is that it is already a part of you. And oftentimes that searching and that assumption that somewhere out there is going to be my calling or my moment or my enlightenment is just a way to hide. And you're hiding from what is already present. So for me, my calling to support families in the adoption process, to empower families to be able to adopt, to get kids out of foster care systems and keep them out of foster care and get kids out of orphanages internationally, is something that I found when I was 28 years old and started working on it, 30 when we launched, but something that was already inside of me from when I was 6 years old. And I talk about this a little bit in my TEDx talk, where I just described that the mark that the world left on me through losing my brothers and sisters and seeing the pain of the foster care process is a pain that was driving me out there to be like, maybe I want to be a photographer, and I work for MTV, and I thought maybe I want to be a writer, and maybe I want to be all these things. When in reality, that mark that had been left on me was this broken part of me that God was going to use, then together we would leave a mark on the world. That looked a whole lot like the mark that had already been on us. And I would say for a person driving right now, you might be driving right now to a job that you hate. You might be driving right now or sitting right now listening to this instead of doing work at the job that you hate. Mm-hmm. Or you might be just in a place where you feel numb and you go, I have everything and I don't sense that. The interior journey is always the odyssey that leads us towards where those marks are. And somewhere along the line, there is a journey there. There is a space there that will drive you towards your calling. And I don't think a calling can come from outside. You can't just believe that something could be your calling. You can't think your way into it. It has to be a deep and profound experience to drive you through all the conference calls and the web X's and the terrible hard days and the expensive days in order to focus on that. And I think it's the same with marriages. I think it's the same with relationships. I think it's the same with parenting. It's why it's such a dramatic neurological experience to have and become a parent, because you have to have that powerful neurological connection, spiritual connection, physiological connection to push you through when your four-year-old screams at you and stomps on the foot and throws food at you. You go, what am I? Any conscious person, I would not be friends with my daughter. We would not be friends. She treats me so bad some days in some moments that we just wouldn't be friends. But we have forged a relationship that transcends the momentary moments like that because we have something that's so powerful that's a part of both of us.
Which is a great example. Then who is that comedian? I always forget his name, the red-haired guy.
There's Louis C.K.
That's him.
Yeah.
Did you ever hear his bit about, my daughter is such an asshole?
Yeah, totally. And how he talks about how being a parent is boring. And it is. I mean, but doing anything great has such long seasons
That's
of
right.
boredom. And I think the tendency for my personality is the minute it gets boring, I start thinking of something else I can do. Mm-hmm. Some other thing I can start, some other company, some other idea, some other brand, some mm-hmm. other website, some other. And when I'm buying domains, I know I'm hiding.
Yeah.
And when I'm out there coming up with new ideas and when I'm sketching out new things, I know I'm hiding from the work that's right in front of me.
So I guess that would be the same thing as not taking care of your intention.
Mm-hmm.
So then you still deal with that. Because I get a lot of people that they see pastors or yogis or even my teacher, Ramdas, who does not hide that you don't lose your neuroses. If you do, you do.
Sure.
But the neuroses for him became like little schmoos, he called them.
Huh.
And they became, oh, there's insecurity. Oh, there you are.
Yeah.
Oh, right. I haven't seen you in a
while. Yeah, that's cool.
Because you develop this like a little less personal. And then as you go on, if you're doing it okay, maybe it gets more. And that's an indication. So it's like something else is driving besides your neurochemicals,
yep,
which are always going to tell you to go outside of yourself,
yep,
and get the high.
Yep.
So it's important that the people that are out there teaching or speaking are speaking from the experience of being in the mud with everybody,
yes,
else.
Absolutely.
Rather than sitting on some, you know, box in the middle of the street saying, no, the way I'm doing it is great and right.
Yeah.
And I've got no problems. You and I, of course, but even our teachers.
Yeah.
Everybody has neuroses.
Yep.
Everybody has days, weeks, months, maybe even years where they're spending, you know, a lot of time on the couch, a right, lot of time watching TV.
Sure, totally.
A lot of time doing stuff that is not feeding their main intention.
Sure.
I just happen to be somebody that thinks that it's hard to remember this when you're watching the fifth season of something and it's been 3 days.
Right.
I mean, not that I've done that in a while, but I have done that at a point in my life.
Sure.
It's hard to remember that those times, they are essential.
Absolutely.
And I would never be so brash or forward to ever claim that I know anybody else's suffering.
Right.
And when that's grace, because I think it could be grace and it could also suck at the same time.
Right.
I just don't think it has to be one or the other.
Sure.
So those moments for anybody listening now, don't think it's any better over here.
Yeah, right.
Because it's not. I got like 90 schmoos sitting around this podcast talk.
Sure.
I mean, podcasts are scary.
Yeah.
This shit is scary.
Totally.
I mean, I've sung in front of thousands of people.
Yeah.
All over the place. You speak to thousands of people.
Totally.
And they're looking to you because in a religion, and we'll get into what exactly that means to you.
Right.
They are looking for answers.
For sure.
And they think that you have a walkie-talkie to right, God.
Right.
And all you have to do is say, they want a new pair of Nike sneakers.
Maybe. I think there might be people who think that. But I think there's so many. There are people around the world who are on a search for answers globally. But I don't think there's any, if there's someone who's not searching for answers, then that person is almost entirely uninteresting.
Well, that's
so no matter how, even your teachers and who all those people are and anyone who's even found a faith, if you're not on a search for answers, you've lost your way.
Yeah, it's funny because there's so many different, I'll call them philosophies,
mm-hmm,
but I may be safer at saying methods,
mm-hmm,
where seeking is not good.
Right, totally.
That always tripped me up.
Sure.
Like, seeking's good, seeking's not good. But what I've narrowed it down, and ask me in 3 days, it might change. But what I've narrowed it down to is it's who in you is seeking. Who in you is doing the seeking.
Mm.
So if it's the me that needs to be busy, if it's the me that's, like you were saying, the minute I buy another domain name, I'm distracting myself.
Yep.
If that's the person seeking, I've never had any luck with that, because when I find what I think I'm looking for, that part of my personality tells me, well, now that you found this, maybe you'll find that.
Sure, yeah, totally.
So it's just this sort of hamster on the wheel, horse and the carrot kind of thing. Obviously, you said it beautifully, that it's an inside job.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I get that. But how do you No, well, let's say, how do you get told that it's an inside job and also be told to go out there and seek?
Hmm.
I'd love to hear. I know what mine is. I'm sure the people listening have heard my interpretation of that.
Sure, yeah.
But what's yours coming from a slightly different perspective with different tools?
And what's it like to seek?
Or what's it like to be told that it's, like, if you were to say to me, I'll be that right in this moment. It's an inside job, Katrina.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next breath you say, you have to want to seek.
Yeah, sure. I think it's twofold. I think the way that you hear that has to come from a place of narrative Me Too-ness.
Oh, yeah.
Let's put it that way.
That's good, yeah.
I think there's a passage in the scriptures where the King David has taken Bathsheba as his wife and has taken her, and then he has impregnated her while his general, Uriah, was off at war.
Hmm.
And he tried to cover it up, and basically he gets Uriah killed because he just can't allow for people to know that he got Uriah's wife pregnant. So he gets him killed and then takes her in, and then hopefully nobody pays attention to the time frame. And there's this prophet named Nathan who comes in. Nathan or Samuel? I gotta Google that. There's a prophet who comes in, and he comes in and he tells David, "I have to tell you a story." And David goes, "Well, tell me the story." He said, "There's a man that has thousands of sheep. And he crosses a bridge to this other farmer's house, and he takes his one sheep that he has. And then he takes that sheep, and then he kills that farmer. What should we do?" And he said, "Well, that's injustice." "What do you mean, what should we do? That's injustice. That person should be held accountable." He said, "You are that man. And you have thousands of sheep and thousands of concubines. And this guy had one wife. And you went and he took his one wife, and then you killed him. What should we do with you?" And he saw himself in that narrative and felt that weight and that burden. And in my mind, the only way to bring about an inward journey is to speak candidly about your own inward journey and what you found and what you located. I don't think it's – or to tell those stories and those narratives. I don't think you can pull that on a person and go, "Let me tell you about your inward journey." Again, that guy was a prophet, right? and a man in power needed to be brought down.
Mm-hmm.
But we all need that person in our life who explains this inward journey, and – you can listen for it and look and go, "That was me. That is my story." When a person tells you about their narrative, I have a friend I'm working with right now who talks about how he had everything going for him in life and he was empty. And he said, "Every time I say that from a stage, heads go down and people cover their face, because it's people with money and fame and people with everything they want, and they feel that emptiness." And only in a narrative, I think, can you be invited to step into that inward journey. No one can force you, and no one can convince you, and no one can beg you. It'd be a person right now who's listening to this going, "I need to go inward. I'm hiding." And I think that's our cultural crisis, is there are more ways to hide now from the story than ever. And you can be Snapchatting or Instagramming or working or phone calling or driving or staying busy or staying active or whatever. And I think that's why it's so impossible to find that quiet, and why meditation is going to explode. I think meditation is going to become the most common practice for every religious stance. You'll find Roman Catholics who are going to start preaching meditation. I think Muslims will start preaching meditation. I think Christians, I think Buddhists, Buddhists were kind of already there for the last couple thousand years.
Yeah.
Everybody is all going to have conversation about mindfulness and meditation, because you can't survive the amount of things that will pull at your attention. It's going to become commonplace, I think, you'll have housewives in Florida who are going to go to meditation class, or will meditate in the morning before they begin their day, because it's going to be so necessary for the survival of our neurohealth. And I think so much of that is, no one can tell you to do that. You just have to know, "Oh, wow, I've been hiding." So that's what I would say is the way to get to the inward journey. And then I think once you've gotten there, and once you realize, okay, I need to start on this inward journey, I think it all begins by paying attention. And I think it all begins for me by paying attention to where God has already been in your life. I don't think you have to go very far to find God in your life. I don't believe you have to go on a quest. I don't believe you have to travel to some faraway place to find God. You were made in God's image. He created you, as the scriptures described, with his own hands. He breathed breath into you. And every time you take a breath, you are experiencing the presence of God, because he gave you that breath. He gave you that breath from his own and breathed life into you. And so when you can pause and when you can stop and look inward and take a deep breath, as you look over your life, present and past, you will see all the moments that God was with you and all the places. And I hope that people who are listening, and I hope people everywhere in my life, and I think people who pause would hear that quiet voice of God saying, "I've been here all along."
And maybe it's a different voice than what the past has put upon you, mm-hmm. listening.
Mm-hmm.
in terms of what your story of that word God means.
Yep.
So maybe if the word God bothers you or stops you and bam, I'm up against this wall because now this guy is saying God is everywhere and
yep.
God is this and God is in me. And here's the thing. So you stopped, right? And you stopped listening to what Hank just said. Or you're sitting there judging now and you're going,
sure.
Oh, he had me until he said,
God.
God is everywhere. Yeah. And God will, I can't even remember what you said, but because I'm remembering my Roman Catholic-ness.
Sure, yeah.
But here's the thing, you know, I think you had said, what did you say the first step would be for somebody if they were on the
internet? To pay attention.
To pay attention. Okay, so for me, it was to get curious.
Yeah.
Instead of, just in this moment, great practice for me, for everybody, you can shut out Hank or shut out the word God and keep doing that and simultaneously question, what does that do for you?
Yeah.
Like, Hank's not here, and if you listen to him, he's putting a magical spell on you. And all of a sudden, tomorrow,
right.
you're going to be a born-again Christian. Not that right. that's the lineage that you're with, but I think we all feel like if we shut down, we're safe again.
Right.
So why don't you notice if there was any judgment or shutting down in this moment right now, because that's the pause that I think you're talking about. You
yeah,
can do that.
Totally.
You can pause in this moment and just say, what is that? Does
bring
that
up for
really
me and what,
threaten me?
Yeah, totally. And curiosity. It's so interesting you say it that way. Curiosity is a surrender.
Absolutely.
It's a form of surrender because if I'm not curious and judgmental, and if a person goes, that guy Hank's an idiot, or well, I can't believe you'd say this, or they're mad at you for bringing me on,
yeah,
and
right.
invading their drive
right.
to work. But at the same time, that curiosity, what it does is it is a surrender of power to go,
I'm willing to know
what new information, and
that's
I'm willing
right.
to know even what comes up for me in that space. And I find that in conflict, that when people feel misunderstood, I watch it happen in interpersonal relationships all the time where people don't want to bring clarity. They don't want to sit down with the person they're in conflict with to discuss the misunderstanding. Because if they did, then they would lose all the power that their anger feels like they give them. And they feel power because they're holding this anger, or they're holding a grudge, or they're mad, and they feel violated. Or even now, they might feel like, well, why is this God? And you feel that certainty. And certainty is a closing and it's a tightening of a muscle.
That's right, constriction.
And curiosity is an openness it's a neurological, it's a spiritual, it's a physical stretching out of your hand to go, I'm willing to receive new.
That's right.
I'm willing to receive something surprising. I'm willing to be pleasantly surprised that this guy might not be insane. And not that I have to agree with him.
No.
But could even what I disagree about bring me to a new place?
That's right.
There's this beautiful, and I'm going to eventually write a book with my friend who's a staunch atheist, hardest-nosed atheist you've ever met. We were roommates for years, and we're going to write a book together, and it's called Disputatio. And in Latin, the word disputatio is where we get the word dispute. Mm-hmm. All that would happen in the Latin world when it would come to things like spirituality or when it come to things like they would have disputes about neuroscience, which in the times they would just call it thinking, or were the disputes they would have about the witchcraft, or they would have disputes about Congress, or they would have disputes about what do we do about this issue in our society. Mm-hmm. And when we have disputes, I come to you with all the evidence I have, you come to the evidence with all you have, and we mm-hmm. see who wins. And oftentimes we need a third party arbiter mm-hmm. or we need a judge of some kind to settle that dispute. Where that is a perversion of what the Latins did with disputatio. It was by asking of questions, I'm going to get the best out of you. And by you asking me questions of my certainty, of my evidence, you'll get the best out of me. And together we will discover a deeper and more profound truth.
Mm.
And to me, that's where we have in political world and in the spiritual world and in the religious world, we have boiled it down to this primal, primitive, caveman level, I'm going to get with all the people who believe my way. You get with all the people you believe your way. And we will catapult evidence at each other and point and shake hands instead of saying, what if we came together and just said, by the most profound questions, we would come to a deeper and more beautiful understanding.
Yeah.
That I would understand my faith in a different way and he would understand his position
instead of
and his understanding of the
living.
Universe.
Yeah.
And by nature, when if a person isn't, this is my conversation with him, to be an atheist is to hold a position that is against or saying you are something. You are, there is no. And so what I keep exploring with him is what word could we use to describe a positive phrase? That's what I dislike about Christianity is that everything that describes a person who's out is a negative term.
Which is what you practice.
Which is what I practice. I'm a pastor. I'm a Christian pastor.
Okay.
And my frustration is it's all, when you the way you described a person is they are a non-believer, an atheist.
Right.
They are a non-Christian. So I said, don't take that word atheist. The church gave you that word.
That's
not your word. That is a negative connotation to who you are and what you believe.
It's fueled.
It's loaded, and it was to brand you as a person who's atheist.
And right away, your brain's going to go, I know what that is, off.
Yeah, right. And you're identifying inherently with a negative term.
Right.
I said, you need to come up with like a, what are you? And he goes, well, maybe I'm like a humanist. I go, good. Let's call you a humanist because you believe in something. Rather than defining yourself by what you don't believe in, which is my issue with Christianity as a whole, is we cannot, as a Christian people, as a people of faith, call everyone a negative term that isn't with us. How binary and childish and Neanderthal that is. That's such a, oh, he has different color skin, we must kill him, he might hurt us. Does that make sense? Like it's a, it doesn't make any logical sense to the evolution of this.
I just had this conversation with my sister because I told her I was bringing you on.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, do you have any, you know, burning questions? And it ended up putting her and I in this conversation. And I'm passionate like you are, so I could yell and scream and just be angry at all.
Sure, totally.
It's just the tools I've been given in this body.
Yeah.
But I ended up saying to her, I just don't understand. It's like, what was the example? I wish she was here right now. It was an example. Oh, I know what I said. This might not make any sense, so I apologize if it doesn't, because I'm kind of known for throwing out these crazy analogies, but it's just where it's in my brain.
Sure, yeah, totally.
It's like somebody whose face, unfortunately, is riddled with acne. Riddled.
Right.
And plagued with acne, getting on TV and sponsoring Proactive.
Sure.
They haven't cured it yet.
Right.
But they're standing there and they're saying, Proactive works.
Yeah, right.
Look at me. And when I use that example as a way to say, it's obvious to me that what religion, the one thing all religious belief systems are saying is that God is love. Okay?
Totally.
Not one is saying anything different.
Right.
God is love. How? Because we're not in confusion as to what love is.
Right.
No, nobody is.
No one.
We all know.
Yep.
But how can religion come in and say to somebody, accept you?
Right.
And accept you.
Right.
And only on Sundays or only on Friday nights at sundown.
Sure.
Or only at my mosque.
Right.
Or only through me.
Yeah.
The priest.
Right.
Hasn't anybody gone, I'm with you, I'm with you, I'm not with you anymore. That doesn't sound like love.
Mm-hmm.
That's not love. There you have it. The end of part one with Hank. He and I were hanging out and talking about the separation many can feel when we stop at one interpretation of traditional religion's definition of love. I heard this acronym the other day. It was SBNR. It was an abbreviating of the term spiritual but not religious. I couldn't help but wonder if we're moving further away from each other with all these titles. There was a time when spirituality included religion and religion included spirituality. Perhaps Hank has gifted us with a call to remember that we are the ones separating it, not scriptures or yoga as the end, but as the roadmaps to what it's like. Not by demanding with interpretations of hell and fire, but by being a way. When our need to know the ineffable, the undefinable, shuts down curiosity toward all other wisdom, no matter what title we give it, we may be knowing ourselves right out of the very essence of all of these teachings. Spiritual laziness can't be the answer, but conditioned love? Part two, coming soon. I'm very grateful to Hank Fortinaire for his incredible passion being out in our world, helping children and parents find each other with love to give and receive without so much red tape. Because love shouldn't have red tape. For more on this, go to adopttogether.org. Maybe for you, maybe for a friend or a family member. It's the world's first crowdfunding site for adoptions. I'm going to end this by just saying, get curious, ask questions, and be vulnerable. See you for part two. Thanks for hanging out with us. Music and editing, special thank you to Ian Hatton. If you'd like more information on Ian, go to mixforpix.com.